am here once again with Tom McCarthy, who is most recently the author of See. Tom, how are you doing?
I'm fine. How nice to see you again.
Yes, how nice to see you too. I've been advised by you to ask not how you feel, so now I'm wondering by asking you how you're doing if I've kind of betrayed what I've just said.
I'm doing briskly.
So we can at least have one bit of small talk. That's acceptable. Okay. Serge says, late in the book, the newspaper headlines have a nice alliterative ring.
Oh yeah, Bulak bludgeoned. Yes. Mr. Block bludgeoned in Bulak.
Yes. Yes. Similarly, this book, it's safe to say that it could be read as a game of monkey see, monkey do, EC homo, insert your bad pun of choice. In a word, there are numerous words beginning with, actually not in a word, but in several words, there are numerous words that begin with the letter C. Carapace, you know.
Cocaine,
copper,
cyanide.
Cable,
yeah.
Control, you name it. The four parts are named after C. So this leads me to wonder, at what point did this come into being during the course of writing? And I'm wondering if there was a maximum C word count that you established during the course of writing this book. Just to start off here.
It came pretty early because the genesis of the book, well, there were several genesis. But one of them was thinking about Carter and Carnarvon, who dug up Tutankhamun. And I knew that a kind of hybrid of those two historical figures was going to be part of... I mean, Serge is a composite of several things, but that's kind of one part or two
yeah.
parts of it. And so as a marker, I just used the letter C. I kind of said, well, Carnarvon, Carter, let's just call him C for now. And it kind of stuck. I liked the single letter title. Made me think of Sesame Street, you know, how like every episode is brought to you by the letter whatever.
C is for cookie. Yeah.
C is for cookie.
But there is
right.
no cookie in this.
No, there's no. That's true. There's no.
You do have cunt at one point.
Yeah, that's true.
That's.
There was lots of C's going on. I mean, the call with a U, you know, of the Wolfman. That was where it originally came from. Although quite a few critics later have pointed out David Copperfield, another C.
The Jennifer Egan review you read.
Yes, of course. Yeah, yeah. And so several others and other people have even pointed out that, you know, when he's born, not only does he have a call, but there is a copper being
sure.
brought to make a transmission field. And I shouldn't not take credit for it because it's brilliant, but
yeah.
I wasn't actually thinking of it at the time.
Well,
but we
could establish how much of the riffing on C was subconscious
yeah.
and how much of it was planned.
I mean, that's the thing. I kind of think of it like pinball. You put a certain number of balls up and then you hope they're going to hit some buffers and maybe, if you're lucky, even go into multi-ball mode, you know, when there's like three of them all going around the ramps and going crazy. But you're not going to control every kind of collision and every which lighting up of which little mushroom buffer at which point it kind of... So yeah, there were some very deliberate throwings out of different C's. And not just C's, I mean a whole chains of association along different kind of mutating phonemes. That's really what the book is. More than characterization
like
or whatever.
Bubbling chemical equation, essentially, with lots
yeah,
of C's.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, exactly. But you know, the really exciting thing was when I remembered that C is the chemical sign for carbon, which is the basic element of all life, and has a kind of proximity to writing, right?
Yeah.
Ink, black, you know, carbon paper, CCs, carbon copies.
BCC.
And BCC and all this kind of stuff. So it just seemed... Yeah, it seemed right. It started out as a marker and then became the kind of the main thing.
The carbon association then came late in this act of writing.
No, I mean, it came early, but
okay.
not at the outset. I didn't start out thinking, you know, it's all going to come down to the chemical sign for carbon.
Yeah.
I hadn't even remembered that C was the
Got
chemical
it.
Sign for carbon. I never did chemistry in school.
Yeah. And then, of course, it's the third novel, C. So.
Yeah, no, also, yep. And I'm already, there's a D figures in the new one, in the next one as well, so.
got it. Well, let's also, I mean, this also leads me to ask you about whether the philosophical strands that you collected and some of the numerous chemicals, obscure words, function in the same kind of, I guess, collage form, that there was no real preordained philosophical ground plan in the course of writing this book, or did you kind of align everything out later, or kind of basically you you put down a bunch of wood, a bunch of stray driftwood from your mine, and then you go. You went ahead and you built the deck, and then you had to smooth out the deck later for the sort of the philosophical direction, or maybe you can talk about
no,
this.
No, right from the off, there was the trajectory was there, the whole narrative arc, and it is a very fundamental narrative arc. It's Orpheus and Eurydice, or rather Isis and Osiris, which is the kind of incest version of Orpheus and Eurydice. Orpheus and Eurydice as brother and sister.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, I think it's one of the fundamental kind of narrative arcs of Western culture. And that was there right from the off. So that's a kind of very linear or parabolic kind of thing and a very conventional thing. But at the same time, I really wanted this, like I was saying, this kind of associative billowing logic. I mean, that's what really makes the book, the whole architecture of correspondences and of echoes and half echoes and mutations and substitutions. And that you can't program from the off. You have to kind of let stuff gestate and then spores, once you have a kind of a culture, you know, to use the kind of in the chemical sense, spores from that go elsewhere and sort of start up new spore colonies in other parts of the whole tapestry, and then you get the links between them. And yeah, that was kind of organic. That happened while it was being constructed.
I'm glad you brought up incest, because insect is a very important part of this book. And of course, we open at the very beginning with a mistyping of a message, the family checking the letters and the typewriter and all that. And of course, it's easy to have a wireless transmission go awry and that to be confused. That particular connection I wanted to ask you about. And also, given that Serge has this tendency to view nearly everybody around him as insects, and that any cable or typewriter is tempted to mangle insect with incest, might this also explain in part, I'm going to go ahead and give it away, Sophie's suicide at the end of the first part, the possible abortion, the unusual relationship between brother and sister?
Totally. I mean, there's a real, there's a very specific literary kind of precedent, two in fact, that I was thinking of with this whole insect incest thing. One is Finnegan's Wake, right? Which is, that pun is made a lot and repeatedly. There are lots of insects in Finnegan's Wake, and lots of incest too. And quite early on, Joyce talks about insectuousness, which also has the sense of being in sections. And he starts riffing on Isis and Osiris, actually. You know, the brother who is dismembered and fragmented, and the sister has to recombine him, almost like a radio signal. And then she can't find the phallus. That's the one missing bit. But the other kind of literary precedent that I had in mind was this magnificent novel by Nabokov called Ardor, A Family Chronicle, which is about a brother-sister incest setup, and it's also awash with insects. Nabokov himself was a lepidopterist and entomologist, and there's one point in that book where they're playing Scrabble, or they're playing an early version of Scrabble, and they got all the letters and they're rearranging them, and they run through the sequence from, I think from insect, they go to scient, like knowledge, knowing, science, to nicest, to incest.
Yes.
So in a way, all of those things are in C, very much, you know, the scientific mission, the kind of pleasure, nicest.
I'm shocked that you didn't mention Kafka as one of your influences.
Oh, God, yeah, no, totally, He's so, he's so...
Considering the bug imagery and all that,
Totally. Yeah. I mean, towards the end of the book, I'm virtually shouting out his name with all the K4, the chess moves and the call signs. It was actually towards the end of, you know, I read Metamorphosis years and years and years ago, and then I reread it while I was writing the final section, and... It's just totally about a brother-sister relationship. All that insect stuff is kind of, it's a smokescreen.
Yeah.
It's about the brother's relation to the sister, who's, it's kind of almost incestuous. And then the kind of twist at the end is she kills him, basically. I mean, she brutally gets rid of him in order to kind of, you know, complete the work of mourning and move everything on. But Kafka, I mean, it's a huge, huge presence, and he's the man, you know, he's absolutely the man.
Sure, I mean, and I mention Kafka because Serge is very bug-like in his relationship with other humans, and this leads me to ask if, at any point, he was even more literally bug-like at any time, because the book could almost be read that way, particularly, you've got the situation where you are reading a book that is very often without emotion and is very philosophical and intellectual. Intellectual field is the specific phrase that constantly comes up throughout the book. Was there more of a conceptual thrust to Serge's nature in terms of him being either half bug or half man? I guess
that's part of it. I mean, he does almost literally become an insect at the end. And even at the beginning, he's a wireless bug. These kids listening to early radio were called bugs, wireless bugs. And a bug is also a kind of glitch, you know, or something wrong in the system. But I don't know if it's not a feeling. I mean, it's a book about networks, you know, radio networks, the early version of the World Wide Web, you know, networks of literature and networks of families and of family secrets and networks of empire and of global political space. But the content of these networks ultimately is desire. I mean, it is a book about desire, and what drives the entire trajectory of the novel is desire. Serge is incredibly, I think he rejects desire at one level. He's not sentimental. He doesn't kind of have these feelings that he can express all the time. You know, there's this tendency, there's this pressure on lots of contemporary fiction to kind of act as though the author were just, or the characters were in some Big Brother diary room, just facing the camera saying, I feel this, I feel that, and they're kind of meant to be authenticated by their feelings. And I'm just totally uninterested in that. I think I'm much more interested in the kind of psychoanalytical tradition where, you know, Freud isn't interested in what somebody says they feel. He's interested in what they don't say and in the gaps and the repetition frequencies. It's all about tuning in and listening and the interference and the mistakes and the crackles. That's the level on which desire kind of filters through. It lies much deeper and it works much deeper, but it's still totally, totally intense. And and I mean, this is a love story. So it's a tender love story about, you know, an impossible love between a young man and his dead sister.
Yeah, sure. But do you think
and he gets to fuck her in the end?
Well, of course. But do you think desire is best understood in these analytical network-like terms better than, say, a kind of intense emotional thing that one would expect? I mean, some reviewers have been rather alarming. Some fair, some not so fair about this, you know, the lack of an emotional connection. It's almost, you know, I mean, Scarlett Thomas in her review said, I don't think this is a novel. So the question is this is a big gamble, taking this kind of analytical, philosophical approach to a very human issue. Were you concerned at any point that it would be misunderstood or misread, or did you not care about anything along those lines?
I don't think it's an analytical approach. I don't think it's an analytical approach. I mean, the whole book plays out not at the level of kind of analysis, but rather at the level of, it's much more visceral. It's about, you know, being in the world, in this world, with its smells and sounds and events and textures and surfaces and, you know, as far as the, you know, several critics have called it an anti-novel, and I just, you know, I don't, good thing is you don't have to respond to these people as an author, but...
Until you talk to snarky interviewers, or...
No, but the point, I mean, if C is an anti-novel, then by that measure, then Ulysses must even more be an anti-novel, and Finnegan's Wake must be an, and Don Quixote, and Tristram Shandy, and Infinite Jest, and in fact, every significant novel in literary history, and Proust, you know, etc., these would all be anti-novels, which leaves the question, well, what the fuck is a novel then?
Yeah.
If those are anti-novels, I mean, it's kind of silly, so it doesn't make sense. I think all interesting novels, for me, kind of, They operate in this network's way. It's about associations. It's about kind of, they're like symphonies. There are echoes across the whole structure, rippling back and forth, this whole kind of acoustic thing going on. And like, you know, if you want to understand Ulysses, there's no point at which Bloom kind of says, I feel this passion, or no one says that. You know, it's about, you follow the chains, the metonymic chains of association through and around the novel, and that's how it does its thing. That's how it signifies, and that's how it, you know...
Thank you.
That's how it works, and that's what I was trying to do.
Thanks.
So, you know, I make no excuses for not being sentimental. I mean, the sentimentalism was a specific kind of decision to reject that.
Sure.
And happy to do so.
Let's talk about the setting of this book. It takes place in World War One. And typically when we think of communications history, we associate it with World War II. What is interesting about your decision to place it there, which I hope to get you to talk about at length, is that you're dealing with there's this animal theme going on with World War One, which I find very interesting. Human beings are about to be turned terribly into lampshades in World War II. In the meantime, we have in this book, in World War One, well, let's go ahead and use animals in that capacity. It's almost as if it's the resurgence to the inevitable point where human beings become nothing more than, you know, conduits for chemicals, and they become a particular resource. I'm wondering, if that had anything to do with your decision to dwell on this very, very early history of communications in World War One and avoid World War Two. Maybe you could talk about this.
Well, the initial kind of another moment of genesis of this novel was I was actually working on an art project at the Institute of Contemporary Arts in London, which was a radio project. I mean, I had a kind of transmission room in the gallery. And it was a kind of reworking or a citation an appropriation of a moment from Jean Cocteau's film Orpheus, yeah, where he listens to the radio and he hears this dead poet transmitting these beautiful, seductive messages on some illicit frequency. And that's what draws him into the underworld. This is in Cocteau's film. But Cocteau got the idea during World War II, in occupied France, you weren't allowed to have radios.
Yeah.
But people did. The Résistance did. And the British would transmit these lines of poetry and sequences of numbers over the airwaves. And most of them meant absolutely nothing. But one in every 500 or whatever meant blow up the bridge now, you know, or assassinate the colonel, or D-Day is tomorrow, or something. So this kind of... this kind of link between, well, in Cocteau's film then, knowing that kind of real kind of political history, social history, there's a link between, you know, technology, the radio, art and literature, you know, poetry and death and a kind of political landscape of occupation and resistance and desire, because it turns out in that film that Death, who's played by this beautiful woman, Maria Cesares, is actually seducing Orfeu. She's drawing him in through this poetry. So anyhow, you know, but that's all a very specific kind of World War II thing. And I think I originally thought that was the original kind of impetus for this book when I was researching around that. But then, you know, I was looking at when radio really emerges, and it's earlier. It does come of age in World War One. I mean, and the book is really specifically set, you know, between 1898 and 1922, which is, you know, between Marconi's first... earliest kind of bumping a signal 10 feet on the one hand, and on the other hand the formation of the BBC, and so there's this wonderful kind of anarchic period which is mirrored by the 90s with that later World Wide Web, you know, in which everyone, loads of people are setting up little, it's many to many, lots of people are setting up DIY stations, all transmitting left, right and centre, and saying we don't want a central broadcaster, and of course that's what they get. The BBC emerges and closes everyone else down, and but 22 as well, you know, it's the great year of European, of literary modernism, The Wasteland, Ulysses, Virginia Woolf, and it's the year Tutankhamun is discovered. So all these things, and it's the year Britain loses Egypt, as it's setting up its pylons in Egypt for its worldwide empire wireless chain. I didn't make that stuff up, it's all historically true. So all these things kind of come together in that period, so that's why I set it there rather than later.
Uh-huh. It was a better convergence point than...
It was a better convergence point. Yeah, 22 is the year, you know.
Got it. Near the end of a third part, Serge gets into a car crash largely because he can only perceive the world rushing by as a fixed frame through which sky and landscape race. Speaking of convergence points, we can get film into this as well. The explanation he offers when people try to extract the car from him is, it won't come off, it's my carapace.
Yes, it's carapace.
Yeah. Now, in light of the fact that the first part ends with Serge opening his eyes to find that the gauzy crepe that's furred his vision for so long is gone, completely gone, like a burst bubble or disintegrated membrane. Why does Serge even need a call? And why must something like an aircraft or an automobile almost serve in lieu of the organic and diaphanous?
I think in this book, there's rather than a kind of progress, there's a set of repetitions or of escalation, same as in Remainder. I mean, it's just the same premise being played out again and again in mutated and ways, and ways in which context, situations in which the stakes are higher each time until death is the only kind of outcome. And so, you know, when he's born, he has one call taken off him. Then he just gets another and another and another. I mean, even at the end, he's pulling back linen in the temple,
yeah.
You know.
I mean,
the whole thing is about this kind of wanting to rip the veil and see beyond it. And at the end of the first section, he does, but what he sees is darkness, but he sees it.
Yeah.
And I suppose this is all the way through. I mean, right at the very end, again, he sees darkness so much that he almost becomes it, the carbon. He becomes this kind of CC, this carbon copy sheet through which everything else is rushing and through which text itself, the book, is printing itself at the cost of his own, you know, life, ultimately. So I suppose maybe he becomes the veil or... There are unveilings and revealings throughout, but it never the veil never goes away.
Well, there's also framings in relation to architectural history, specifically the second part where you name check or use the image of the Eiffel Tower. There's the airfield accident when Serge describes the machine. Oh, it looks like the Eiffel Tower, if one of its legs snapped off and started tilting. And then 30 pages later, Serge is actually having this level of affirmation. Like, you know,
he is
the Eiffel Tower.
Well, the Eiffel Tower comes in earlier when he's listening to the radio, because that's what sends out Paris's call sign, FL, for
yes.
Eiffel.
Yeah. Yes, and of course, the Eiffel Tower's early beginnings as a radio figure,
exactly. It's a radio transmitter, yeah.
So it
broadcasts time. The time pips come. They didn't come from Greenwich then. They came from the Eiffel Tower. So this tower actually transmits time around the world, you know.
So really, any kind of landmark associated with history or any specific figure associated with history was just, as a matter of course, during your research, just going to make its way into Serge's narrative.
Yeah, sure. It's a kind of winding in. I mean, the whole book is, you know, it's winding in a lot of things through its associative kind of mechanism. I mean, that's what I wanted to do. And lots of those are historical, and lots of them are kind of literary. You know, there's lots of other text bubbling away beneath the surface, I mean, and kind of breaking through, and I was quite deliberate about or quite unashamed about kind of showing that. I mean, like, you know, the character Morgan Petru is just the middle name of E.M. Forster and the middle name of C.P. Cavafy, who are both Alexandrian writers from that period, and even some of the lines they use are taken from sampled from their work. So in a way, I mean, everything kind of has, and news reports and stock market prices and everything, it's this whole kind of, it's like when you listen to the radio during that time, everything is just information, it's all coming at you.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted the novel to be like, in a way, just winding this stuff.
Yeah. So the information you were receiving from concrete events was more of a creative liberating force for this novel than, say, making shit up.
Yeah, you get the information and then you reconfigure it. I mean, for example, I didn't know until I went to the Imperial War Museum that the observer faced backwards, just like the Angel of History in Walter Benjamin's thinking. The Angel of History always faces backwards and sees the destruction. That's what Benjamin says about, he's looking at a Paul Klee painting called Angelus Novus, where this angel seems to hover over a something that looks like kind of Hiroshima, basically, looking at it as he moves away. And anyhow, you know, it's you couldn't make that kind of stuff up. This idea of looking backwards as this kind of landscape of destruction slides out from beneath the tail like a kind of ticker tape strip, and or in the Egypt section, you know, the stuff about pylons and or the fact that there was this convergence of Egyptologists and spies and in Cairo at that time. I mean, it's kind of rich information, and so anything that kind of made sense in terms of the rest of the book, anything that could kind of correspond with something else was in, you know.
So the angel, this perhaps explains in part Serge's sexual preference. The only thing he says is, I just like it.
I like it that way.
Yeah, I like it that way.
Well, he sees, this is straight from, I mean, another really big kind of constituent part of Serge is the Wolfman.
Yeah.
Freud's case history about a guy called Sergei.
Yeah.
Sergei Pankayev, SP. And he has this predilection for sex at ergo, i.e. doggy style, because, says Freud, he sees his parents doing it. That's his primal scene. He sees his parents doing it one night. And this image kind of fixates on his mind and gets blended with other images. Freud talks about screen memories. If you have a screen, you can have several films projected onto it. They all become one kind of film. But this is the main part of that film, is this image of the parents copulating. And so the Wolfman is always doing it that way too. This kind of traumatic reenactment. And like in Remainder as well, I guess. And so, yeah, that's very much what Serge is doing. And in fact, I even made it quite... I literalize Freud's metaphor. So he literally sees a screen. I mean, it's a kind of pornographic film that's inadvertently made because two figures behind it are copulating that way.
Yeah.
And there's a lamp behind them throwing up their shadows onto the screen. So he watches a kind of Indonesian shadow puppet porno film, yeah, and then just reenacts it for the rest of his life.
You brought up Remainder and the reenactments, and I actually did want to ask you about that because another C from Remainder, Cordite, appears,
yeah,
of course,
right,
in this, which I got you on last time as well. But I wanted to actually ask you because in the beginning of the third part, Serge bemoans the predetermined nature of his social interactions. He says as though they'd already happened and were simply being reenacted by two more people and who'd agreed to maintain the farcical pretense that this was something new and exciting. So this leads me to ask, since we're on the subject, to what extent C is married to Remainder or is possibly an extension of it. I mean, in Remainder, the protagonist, of course, experiences that accident, and we have, I suppose, an excuse to feel sorry for him. Whereas in this, no such accident. No, he just becomes that way. The call is removed, and then he just operates on this almost sociopathic level. I wanted to ask you if what you wanted to do here was really ride the gas further here in the car with C, to offer another C, to really kind of examine what it is to be alive, to be so, to view people largely in this kind of predetermination or reenactment sort of status.
I think it's maybe it's even a prequel to Remainder. When my editor at Knopf first read this, he said, wow, this guy is the grandfather. Serge is the grandfather of the guy in Remainder. And the thought had crossed my mind as well. And there is, you mentioned it, there's that kind of almost an in-joke. I mean, in Remainder, when he smells the liver, he goes, you know, it smells like cordite.
Yeah.
And this time, when he smells cordite in the war, he says it smells like liver. So there's a kind of...
But it would explain the cordite in Remainder.
Yes, it would. It would, exactly. Remainder is... Oops. I mean, they're both trauma victims.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, in Remainder, the trauma is never named. It's something falling from the sky.
Yeah.
In this book, the trauma is named. I mean, it's the loss of his sister. It's a direct family trauma. And even before that, the seduction by his sister,
sure,
is this kind of, that's the kind of pre-trauma. So those are that's the combined trauma that he's, you know, whose implications he's acting out for the rest of his life. But no, in both cases, in both books, subjectivity has the structure of trauma, and this is for Freud. This is absolutely the case, right? We are what constitutes us as being human ultimately is a relation to trauma. I mean, by the end of his career, Freud's writing about, you know, amoebae just reenacting endlessly their trauma, the fact of having been photosynthetically traumatized by the sun.
Yeah.
These pulsing waves of repetition that propel them through the sea backwards like the angel of history again, you know. And this is the structure of subjectivity in both those novels. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
I'm curious how much you relied on Freud for the third person perspective of Serge, because the prose itself almost becomes an extension of his really unusual way of dealing with people. You know, it goes even beyond the dialogue in terms of you know, how he feels, like we were mentioning the Eiffel Tower before, but the pros is willing to give him that, I suppose, case study-like quality. This leads me to wonder if you did, in fact, try to mimic Freud to some degree in the creation of this prose.
I mean, what's really interesting about Freud is that if you talk to almost any psychologist, they'll be totally dismissive. Yeah. They'll say he's a maverick, he's a fraud, and so on. You know, we've discredited him. We've moved on. We put electrodes on people's brains, and that explains mental life, and or some such crap. You know, and but his impact has within the arts has been absolutely enormous. I mean, immeasurably giant on visual art, on film, on literature, and in philosophy, and. And what I love about reading Freud is he's just such a great writer. He has the mind of a novelist. I mean, I was saying a minute ago, you know, in really good novels, meaning works associatively, and this is not coincidentally exactly the way Freud sees mental life.
Yeah.
You know, he follows the chains of association round his patient's life. And their behavior at levels that play out much bigger than the individual. You know, by the end, he's almost an anthropologist writing about, you know, neurotic behavior in societies as a whole. So his characters, his patients are like literary characters. And in fact, some of his best patients are literary characters, like Norbert from Jensen's Gradiva. I mean, he does a psychoanalysis of a literary figure, or Judge Schreiber, who he never met. He only ever read a text, you know, so. And then his kind of main models are people like Oedipus and, you know, Antigone and Hamlet, you know, who are literary creations. So I think, you know, in Freud, there's this kind of real blurring of life and literature. Literature becomes the model for life.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what I really love about him. So I don't think I use Freud as a kind of analytical framework at all. I just use it as an inspiration, actually.
But he is very much like the Telegraph in the sense that the Telegraph has also been forgotten. In 1999, they stopped using Morse code on the seas. So Pete, we completely disregard the fact that you needed to have Freud and you needed to have the Telegraph before you have everything that we now enjoy today. So I'm curious if you know, that connection between Freud and the Telegraph was there in concocting this book.
Another interesting thing about Freud is that lots of his models for mental life are totally, they're things like recording devices, tape recorders, like what you're using here, or you know, dictation machines or writing pads, you know, the type where you write on and then you peel it away and the imprint is still there beneath, but it's disappeared on top, the mystic writing pad. So there's a kind of mechanistic thing going on in Freud, you know, that there's these emergent technologies that were emerging while he was writing, the telegraph, the telephone and so on, really infiltrate his thinking massively till he thinks of us as being like telephones and telegraphs. Someone else who does that is Kafka, of course.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
So, yeah.
The going back to the issue that we kind of brought up but didn't really delve into further, I wanted to talk about the idea of the animals as kind of a resource. The mummified cat is fertilizer. The rats I was mentioning that follow oily technology in the river. The animals here used as material goods. I'm wondering why that was. I mean, it seems to me that it wasn't specifically intended as a kind of a warm-up for World War II, but what of this this concern for animals as resources?
I don't know. It's funny you mention that. I mean, I hadn't really thought about it. I mean, with the mummified cats, I just thought it was funny to have all these dead cats because there were so many dead cats in Remainder.
Yeah.
I just thought it'd be good to carry on this tradition of killing cats.
Yes.
In my books. And and then I was reading a biography of Alexander Bell, who invented the telephone after losing two brothers. And they had they killed the family dog. They poisoned the family dog and stripped its... removed its larynx to use as a voice box. He was a kind of proto Frankenstein in a way, using, you know, wetware, soft tissue for turning soft tissue into technology, into communication technology. against the backdrop of kind of, you know, an attempt to reanimate his dead siblings. So I suppose that was kind of in there, but it wasn't really a systematic thing. The rat in the river, I think those aren't machine parts. I think they're dead bodies under the tarpaulin. It's left
used
vague,
resources.
Used resources, yeah. I mean, he thinks they could be machine parts or maybe animals. I think they're corpses being kind of, you know, casted down river en masse and this kind of industrial scale, yeah.
When Serge goes to the hotel, we were talking about K4, you write, nationality seems less of a defining label here than a type of illness. The K4 to X move of most long-serving inmates when they meet a fresh one is to inquire not where the new arrival's from, but rather what he or she's got wrong with them. Similarly, since this is coming before World War I, I'm wondering, are you making the philosophical suggestion that nationality as an illness or something to be diagnosed as a precondition to war? Or?
Yeah. I mean, that whole section is a massively riffing off Thomas Mann. I mean, it's a huge kind of tribute to the Magic Mountain, which also takes place in a health spa in the lead up to World War I, a pneumonia health spa in Mann's case. But what's kind of... Okay, melancholia. Serge is a melancholic. I mean, that's what he is. That's his character. And I guess he takes his place in a long line of other literary melancholics like Hamlet and Antigone, who I mentioned earlier, and, you know, Goethe's Werther, and, you know, there's many of them. And but researching melancholia, I found out that originally it was conceived as a totally material illness. Melachole means black bile, and it was thought that melancholics had an excess of black bile in their stomachs. It was a alimentary ailment. Just as hysteria was a kind of to do with a woman's womb, it wasn't to do with your mind or whatever. And there's a point when they're in the spa when everyone there has got some kind of stomach ailment or rheumatism or something, and the doctor says, this is the problem with Europe, you know, the black bile is everywhere, too much crap in their stomach, they're all blocked up, they're all so yeah, it's a kind of microcosm of the world, kind of viewed through this kind of slightly odd regressive material lens of kind of, yeah, an almost medieval conception of our humours and of our bodies and the uses to which they're going to be put.
So Europe is basically a better location to examine these philosophical arguments.
I think so, at that point, for sure. Yeah.
Do you have any possible plans on looking at it from a, you know, an Eastern perspective? I'm not going to say American's perspective, because that'd be very presumptuous of me here. It would be my own illness.
I don't know. You know, it's kind of... Talking of nationality, you know, Remainder kept getting described as a French novel.
Yeah.
And I think C is very much a German novel. I mean, lots of the influences in it are German. You know, with Freud and Mann and a whole bunch of others. I don't know, like Musil and Georg Trakl is really kind of present in the war section and so on. And I don't know, it'd be nice to write an American novel, although it has been done very, very well of late. I'm a bit daunted by the idea of writing the American novel because there are a lot of very good ones.
You could only write the British novel or the McCarthy novel? I wonder,
America, maybe America's unique in that, you know, you'd never say you'd never say of Proust, this is the French novel, this is the novel that sums up France. You know, whereas of course, well, you do say that of Huckleberry Finn or of Moby Dick or of Gravity's Rainbow, even though most of it's set in Europe.
Yeah,
it's still kind of the American novel. Maybe America's unique in that respect. I mean, it already is this kind of great speculative poem composed by, you know, mankind in general, and it kind of almost is like a novel, you know.
Well, the French were ahead of us philosophically, so we have to lay claim to something here, I suppose.
The novel played out in real... No, but all these writers, like, you know, everyone, DeLillo, whoever, David Foster Wallace, it's always that their subject is given to them. It's America. Updike, all of them, Philip Roth, they're writing about America. Dickens isn't really writing about England. I mean, he's setting it in England, but it's not a kind of, this is England. I mean, in the same way as, you know, as most American novels kind of are about, you know, it's the muse. America is the muse. I can't think of another country in which this is the case, or at least not to that degree.
Well, we may very well have a situation here where, regrettably, we must view every aspect of the human condition through this nationalistic prism. I don't know.
But it's not, you know, there's this enormous disappointment. You know, Allen Ginsberg has this line somewhere like, oh, America, why can't you be angelic? Or, you know, William Burroughs calls it, says America is the last and greatest betrayal of the last and greatest of human dreams. There's this real anger and nostalgia and sense of disappointment in it, which is, you know, in many of the great American writers, you know, they probably have their books burnt by your more Republican-minded kind of patriots, if they bother to read them. I mean, they're very anti-American in many respects. And,
give us
and
a few
critical.
Years here. Yeah. Then we'll have the book burning, You see what happens in November. Right? Well, on that subject of delightful book burning, Tom, thanks very much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
All right. See the handshake.
Yeah.